Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Wunner Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor and lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
Okay, wake up, dead man.
Wake up.
The third in Rian Johnson's Knives Out trilogy, once again starring Daniel Craig as the inimitable Benoit Blanc. What a great, I said this in my spoiler-free breakdown, but like, yeah. How lucky are we to get to witness the creation of a character like Benoit Blanc?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a brand new character, and we're getting to like watch him become like a screen legend, like a legendary screen character in real time.
Yep.
You know,
I love that too. I thought the exact same thing, because like murder mysteries for some reason just do really well with a character like this. You know, there's Hercule Poirot, or however he says
it. Hercule Poirot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's a very interesting character. He's not nearly as interesting as Daniel Craig, but he's a good character that,
yeah,
you know,
I feel like most of them that I can think of are like TV shows, like Columbo or Murder, She Wrote, or
Monk.
Yeah. Monk. Yeah. You know, I guess it's a good format for a TV show where you just, you know, I also liked in this. So I went back and I rewatched.
All of them.
Because a lot of people are talking about like, well, which one's your favorite? And like when people talk in their reviews, they're like, I'm not sure if this is my favorite one. And honestly, when I was done watching all of them, I was like, I don't know how you pick a favorite movie in this trilogy.
No.
They're all so good, and they're all like very different, and have like, they all have like things about them that I think make them really special and great and funny and cool. And the kind of uniting fibers of all three is like Rian Johnson's really, really sharp writing and Daniel Craig's really strong central performance, but the whole ensemble in all three of them is very strong.
Yeah, they really, really are. And that's what makes these movies interesting, is because they're all self-contained and I mean, even Benoit Blanc he's not referencing things from previous movies, really.
No,
it just all makes it its own thing. So,
and you could watch any of them in any order.
Yeah. 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 It doesn't matter.
Doesn't need to be 1, 2, 3. They don't.
No. I think that's the genius of it, you know, and I think that's the way to go. And if he wants to make more of these, I'm down to watch him, because I really love watching Benoit Blanc.
I would keep watching these as long as he wants to make these, as long as Daniel Craig wants to play the character. I even said, I was like, I could see this character, Benoit Blanc, having a life beyond Daniel Craig, beyond Rian Johnson, and becoming a character that goes on to be in movies for 60, 70, 80 years, you know,
probably.
And it's cool to be at the beginning of that. I think that's how strong these films are. And I hope that Johnson and Craig get to make, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 of them together at least. Mm-hmm. Because until you miss, I'm there. Cause so far we're 3 in, and you have not, like, they haven't missed for me. They've all been very, very good. But I was going to say, in the rewatch, I noticed that they reference like just different things. Like in the first one, Ana de Armas's mom is watching reruns of Murder, She Wrote, but it's dubbed in Spanish. And I was like, I bet Rian Johnson put an episode on that has something to do with the plot of this film. But since it's in Spanish, the audience doesn't know that it's like,
probably.
You know, like, I bet he would do something like that. And then in the second one, in Glass Onion, at the beginning, because it's a COVID movie, Benoit Blanc is in the bathtub, and he's playing Among Us, that like game that Gen Z got really into during COVID. And he's playing Among Us with Stephen Sondheim and Angela Lansbury and who else is he playing it with? I can't remember. There's someone else that's like another legend, and Natasha Lyonne, and they're all playing Among Us together.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's keep making them, man.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoy them. I think they're done really well. And I like how different each one is, and they're all similar in tone in many ways, but just they are all very unique.
Well, they're all about different things. All have they all have a similar structure in that it's Benoit Blanc as kind of the title main character. And then it's Benoit Blanc with another character who's like his sidekick main character protagonist that takes him through that adventure. So in the first one, it's Ana de Armas. In the second one, it's Janelle Monáe. Yeah. And in this one, it's Josh O'Connor. And Josh O'Connor probably has the biggest role of any of these people we've seen.
Yeah. I mean, because Daniel Craig doesn't show it well. He shows up in the very beginning. He's reading a letter for about 2 seconds.
It's a structural thing. Because the movie is structured the way it is, he doesn't enter the film till we're 35 minutes in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time, which I thought worked really, really well. Because his entrance is so, the way that they had him enter was amazing. So it almost felt like this new character coming in, even though we know who he is.
Right.
But it was it was an introduction to Josh O'Connor. So I thought this was a great movie too, because this, as you said, each one kind of has different themes that it's regarding. And this one is a big one that I've been very interested to talk to you about, because it's very religious. As we talked about in our last podcast with Eternity, they don't really go into the religious aspect, which worked for that movie, but this one they really did.
Yeah.
And I thought they handled it very, very well. And I really, really enjoyed it, because Rian Johnson is simultaneously criticizing religion while also appreciating or praising it for what it can be when it's used correctly. And I thought it was done really, really well. But I mean, what were your thoughts as somebody who, I mean, me, I related to it because I'm much more of a religious person and you are not. I mean, in a good way, not in a bad way, but just, but we're able to, so I don't know. What were your thoughts on that aspect of it?
Oh, I liked it a lot. You and I talk about this a lot on the show that I don't mind movies about faith. I just like when they're done in an artful, tactful way.
Yes.
I we talked about Signs and how we think it's a very good movie about faith that doesn't beat the audience over the head with any one particular theology or something. Yeah. I think that, I mean, this movie's about the Catholic Church, but our primary character who we're sort of experiencing the movie through in Josh O'Connor, even though he's a Catholic priest, his view on religion and a relationship with God and faith doesn't necessarily, it's not about the Catholic Church is the end all be all of truth. It's just about that was the conduit through which he got to experience God, and being a priest gives him the opportunity to do something that he feels called to do in the world, which is just help people.
Yeah.
And just to sort of be a comfort to people. Yeah. And I think that he could have come to that through lots of different avenues and he would have been just as happy. But the Catholic Church has this particular structure where a priest is sort of, embedded into a community and there for the sole purpose of being a kind of, spiritual shepherd for that particular flock, and one of the biggest central conflicts in this film is between Josh O'Connor and the Monsignor of the parish that he is sent to, played by
Josh Brolin.
What a year for Josh Brolin.
I know, really.
Weapons, Running Man, and this.
Yeah.
What a crazy,
and he was in Dune last year. It's not like a career resurgence. It's just a great year.
Just what a 2025 has been strong.
Yeah.
And if Running Man is your worst showing in that's not bad.
Yeah.
And the other two are fantastic. Weapons was one of the best movies of the year. And I think Wake Up Dead Man is one of the best films of the year.
It's awesome. Yeah.
This is our spoiler laden review. So if you want to see us talk about this movie without spoilers, you can go over to the channel and we have our spoiler free thoughts. If you still haven't seen Wake Up Dead Man, let's talk about before we get into the plot, why Netflix is so committed to not releasing these movies in the theater. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And I really I've read a lot of stuff of why they keep making up excuses for why they're not putting things in theaters. And I think they're all wrong. Ted Sarandos is it's outmoded and people want to watch things at home. I'm like, no, they don't. Like, I went to a theater that was packed.
Me too.
It was a Wednesday night. It wasn't full, but it was packed. Like, I ton of people there. Great experience. Netflix keeps saying things, you know, like I said, like they think it's outmoded. I heard someone, and I tried to find the quote off to see if I can find it again, but they're saying, well, we originally, you know, promised our customers that they could have an at-home experience, and we don't want to go back on our promise. And I was like, well, here's the thing. You also promised me no ads, and now you sell ads all the time. So why do you not like money?
Like, burn Netflix.
Just put them in theaters. People will see them in the theater. I was happy to spend money. This is a movie that you should see in a theater.
This idea that the theater is outmoded, I'm not going to deny that. I definitely know there are like people out there who are done with movie theaters. Like, I've met them, and I've seen them online. People who are like, I don't go to movie theaters anymore.
Right.
A lot of people complain about the price, that they just say it's too expensive to, like, every time I go to a movie theater,
very with valid the
ticket and concessions, that I'm spending $40 to $50 every time. Like, it's crazy.
Very valid.
And I'm like, okay, fair enough. To me, like, it is like, I have a membership to AMC Stubs. Yeah. I pay $25 a month and I get to see up to 4 movies a week, which is more than I ever need. Yeah, but if I go to the movies, I go to the movies 4 times a month, because we go see a movie every week, and that's like $6 every time I go.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I and a lot of theaters have subscription services like this now, where you can just pay a monthly fee to, like, go see 3 or 4 movies, you know. And then, like, there's also benefits where, like, I get free concessions from time to time. And also, just the viewing experience is, in my subjective opinion, just so far superior. And even if you're a person who's like, I'm done with theaters, I don't think that you can, in good faith, argue that your home viewing experience is better. No. I think that you might be accustomed to liking being able to pause it when you want, being able to go to the bathroom when you want, looking at your phone and not having to, but, like, come on. There's something nice about turning your phone off, sitting down in a nice big theater recliner and, like, getting in the dark and the sound and
having a shared experience with other people.
Yeah.
Like, you when you have a good theater and you have a lot of people, like, the best theater experience I've probably ever had was at Endgame, right?
Yeah.
Avengers Endgame, which was just, it's not my favorite movie, but that was probably the best theater experience I had. Everybody was into it. Everybody was excited. You feel the energy when that happens. And same thing with Wake Up Dead Man. Like, I had a lady scream next to me at the top of her lungs when it flashed and Josh Brolin was there, you know, like after the resurrection, you know, and I just started laughing because she screamed so loud, and everybody was laughing when they were supposed to laugh. It's contagious, this feeling. And when you're at your home, if you want to watch movies at home, that's totally fine, but you don't get that other experience. You are distracted. You can't fully commit, because I paid to go and see this movie. So I'm going to put my phone away. I'm going to watch. And yes, it sucks when you pay for a movie that's not good, but also that's just the chance. Like, there's a million things you can pay for that aren't good. So I get it. And the prices, if prices were less, more people would see movies. I don't know why they don't reduce the prices on movies, but that's a conversation for something else. But
also, let's say that since COVID, let's say in the last 5 years, 20 to 30% of the population who used to routinely go to movie theaters has sworn off them and boycotted them. I still am like, the investment that Netflix makes into a movie like Wake Up Dead Man to pay a cast this big, and the fact that, like, in my opinion, these have become event films. It's like, at this point, it's like, it's exciting that a new Knives Out mystery is coming out. And now, especially after this one, it's like, they're 3 for 3. And the next one that they're making is going to be a big deal. Like, this is a popular franchise now. And I just am like, I know that you have this deal with your audience that you told them that you give them an at-home experience, but, like, what's wrong with giving them an at-home experience in a month? Why? Yeah. Not? Like, just tell them they can watch it at home in January.
Yeah.
Like, why not finish out the year on a really strong theatrical run and like make $50 or $60 million? Like, what,
yeah, I know.
Even if you don't make your budget back, what are, I just don't know why you don't want the money. Like,
well, yeah. And Netflix, please contact me to understand how your movies make money, because, right. And I mean, I get it. You have millions of people who subscribe every month. Okay. So you're making a lot of money, but how much content are you putting out that's new? Like, I pay what, you know, $13 a month or whatever it is. My 13, I think it's bucks,
like 17 now or something.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah.
How is my money split between your 70 or 80 different pieces of content? Like, that's, it's not making a lot of money.
All of the people who are working on those shows, these, like, every one of these TV shows, Wednesday, Stranger Things, like, every, like, these are big shows with big budgets, and they have massive crews and massive effects budgets. And I know that you guys are, you're bringing in what, I don't know, friggin' $70 million a month. Like,
probably more,
you know, probably more than that. I, you know, but like, again, like, you've got a ton of overhead. And when you make a big event film like this with a bunch of movie stars in it, with Rian Johnson, who's a very like well-known popular filmmaker, why not? Even if the goal isn't to break even and make your money back or even make a profit, why not at least just get, what's the harm in just collecting a little more money?
Yeah, you're taking a huge chunk out of your deficit. Like, just, and again, hey, if I'm sure there's a ton in these financials. If you guys want to contact me and explain everything to me, I would love to know why. But like, what, even if you don't make your budget back, if you make $10 million, that's $10 million quicker than you would get splitting all the profits between your monthly income to all the different pieces of content that you're bringing in.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, see this movie in the theater. That's the point we're getting at.
If you can. If it's playing in the theater near you, go see it. Yeah. It's worth it. This one thing that Rian Johnson does really well in this series so far, and because I just rewatched it, I'm like, oh yeah, he is from the jump, he always sort of shows the audience like a new dimension of this. Like, it's always like the tonally, all three films have their own identity, and he's always finding ways to keep the formula fresh. And this one's no exception. Like you said, we open with Benoit Blanc reading this letter, and we don't know if the letter was mailed to him or how he came by this letter, but Josh O'Connor, our other main character, is narrating, and we go right into the world of the narration.
Yeah.
And we get like, you know, but right away he tells us about that. He's about to explain the events of the Good Friday. Was it Good Friday or Black Friday? Was it Good Friday?
Good Friday.
The Good Friday murder at this church that he was at. Mm-hmm. And so unlike the other two films, we know from the opening moments, it's like this murder has taken place and this person is describing the murder. Yeah. Whereas in the first two films, it's like in Knives Out, the murder happens and, you know, we get a whole opening sequence and then the murder happens and then Benoit Blanc gets folded in and, you know, and Glass Onion does a whole other thing structurally, but this one, it's like, we're right into it and he's explaining these events and it's a nice way of doing all the exposition we need to do for these films because Josh O'Connor, he's written this letter to Benoit Blanc. We don't know why, but he's describing how he came to be at the parish, who the main players are at the parish. That's another big element of these films, just like Clue or any Agatha Christie novel. Yep. They all are ensemble pieces. And so we get introduced to all of our, you know, ensemble members. We got Jeremy Renner. We got Andrew Scott. We got,
Kerry Washington,
Glenn Close.
Yeah. Kaylee Spaney. And Thomas Hayden Church.
Thomas Hayden Church is back. The Sandman. Back.
Yeah. Jeffrey Wright. He's in the very beginning in a little cameo, which I love.
That's right. We also find out pretty quickly that like,
oh, Glenn Close.
Yeah. Glenn Close. I said Glenn Close.
Oh, you did. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. But we find out pretty quickly that this priest, Josh O'Connor's character, Father, I can't remember.
Judd.
Father Judd. Yeah.
Duplantisy or something.
I don't think I knew that. They just call him Father Judd.
They do.
But he's different You know, he's a cool priest. Like
he's got a neck tattoo.
Got a little neck tat. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. And then he also, like, we're introduced to him. He punches another priest in the face. Like we don't even hear what the other priest was saying, but like, yeah, he's just listening to him. And then he's like, just decks this guy in the face.
Yeah. and find out he's a former boxer.
Yeah. And he gets sent to, and this is later, but we find out like he killed a guy in the ring, yeah, and like that's what led him to his faith and everything. But that's what gets him sent to this church. And it's almost like as a punishment, he thinks, because the guy who, the Monsignor who runs this church, is kind of unhinged. And it's Josh Brolin, who he's like, the thing about, this is sort of a theme in this franchise, is Rian Johnson is definitely like having his way with sort of conservative culture in all three films.
It's very obvious.
Yeah. And it's definitely in Glass Onion. It's like Glass Onion's making fun of like the aristocracy, like the oligarch class, like the billionaires and the disruptors, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Elon Musks. Knives Out is making fun of, you know, trust fund families that are just sort of leeches off of generational wealth. And this movie is making fun of kind of the religious aspect of conservative people, you know, the kind of like MAGA people, like the MAHA movement and the wellness influencers and things like that. But so that's definitely Rian Johnson's like personal politics baked into each.
Yeah. It's very apparent.
Yeah. Also, like we found out in the second film, which isn't even the first one, that Benoit Blanc is gay, and
I forgot about that.
Yeah, his husband is Hugh Grant.
Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. I need to see. That's right. I should have watched those again. But we find out in this one. What would you say that he is? Would you say that he's agnostic or that he's atheist, or what would you? Because he, in this movie, we do find out he does not believe in God.
Uh huh.
He grew up in a religious something. Uh-huh. But he doesn't believe in it. Well, I mean, what was your take on him?
I think he's atheist. I think that Benoit Blanc is a person who's like, you're going to have to show me the evidence.
Yes, like, I can see that more. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like you're going to have to show me how the puzzle pieces fit. Yeah. And if it's just believe me, I'm out. You know?
Yeah, because I think he is, which fits with the character.
Totally.
Because he's very much I have to believe it and I have to prove it with the facts, because that's that's what he is. So I thought it was a great. And I love the relationship between Benoit Blanc and, you know, Father Judd.
Yeah.
Because they're on this two sides of the spectrum, but they never, like, they had so much respect for each other in the way of, like, just respectfully talking about things that, like, why can't more people do this? You know?
Well, like, Benoit Blanc's, like, the thing that Benoit Blanc exists to do is to bring the truth to light. Like, that is, like, his calling as a character in all three of these films is, like, there's, like, his sort of calling in the world is just a guy who, like, he kind of talks about it in this film, in Wake Up Dead Man, where he's, like, oh, like, it's impossible for me to not solve a crime. He's like,
He's
like, totally. He's just like, my nose just is drawn toward in the direction and the path of the truth. Like, I will find out what's true in this situation. It doesn't matter how, like, convoluted it seems. Like, I will figure it out. And Father Judd's calling has less to do with, like, empirical truth and truth that you can prove with facts and evidence.
Yeah.
It has more to do with just like, there's a way that something can be valuable and not be demonstrable through some kind of, you know, evidence-based process. Like, and that's what puts them it's just like, I think that Rian Johnson's a really strong writer. And I think personally, I kind of think this is the best screenplay he's written in this trilogy so far.
Yeah, I think you're right, because it's amazing how well it works.
Yeah,
even if you don't think it's your favorite movie of these three, I agree. I think it's just probably written the best. Just the characters work so well off of each other and how it all comes together. So he gets sent to this little town in New York. I can't remember what the town is. I should probably know that.
But upstate small town, the priest, the Monsignor there doesn't even seem to care if he like gets converts or retains members. He just has his loyal flock of followers. And basically every week he just like, he gives these like fiery homilies where he's screaming at the crowd. And also like, when he shows up, one of the first things he sees is that there's no crucifix and there's like a shadow, kind of like Signs. There's an outline on the wall of where the crucifix used to be. And so, you know, the Monsignor comes in at one point and sees him measuring the wall. And he's like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, I was going to put up a crucifix. And he's like, no, we leave that there as a reminder of the harlot whore. And he's like, what does that even mean? And so he gives us this necessary backstory that, the Monsignor, when he was a boy,
I think it's Glenn Close who gives it, right?
I think that the Monsignor says it first.
Okay.
But then Glenn Close also says it separately. He's like, we leave that up there as a reminder of the harlot.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like, what? And then, like, you know, he's like, well, that's his mom, who, we find out that his grandfather, who is the original priest of this parish, was a very wealthy man somehow. I guess he had made a bunch of money before he took up the cloth and had a bunch of money in investments. And his mother stood to inherit all of his money, but she was a loose woman. She was
she enjoyed the finer things, you know, clothes and those. Yeah.
And she liked philandering and she liked, you know, partying.
Well,
and drinking
she had the Monsignor with some drifter that nobody knows about.
So she was looked down on as like a ungodly woman, but her dad basically said, if you want this money when I die, you have to stay here. You have to, like, you have to live in my house. So she begrudgingly sort of raised her kid in this house, around this church, around this parish. Mm-hmm. But then when her father died, his bank accounts were empty and she couldn't find his,
she thought he hid it somewhere. And so they say that she tore up the church and she was throwing everything down looking for this treasure and she never found it.
Glenn Close's character, who comes in as a child, catches her tearing up the church and she like pounces on her and beats her silly. Like,
Okay. This movie cheats a little.
Yeah.
And this was one of those cheats, which is fine. It's not bad. But I don't think there's any way that you could figure out the end of this story if you don't cheat. And he did. And this is one of those scenes that we'll get to later. But
what's the cheat?
She doesn't tell it exactly how it happened. You know, like, I mean, she says that she saw the father die, you know, when in reality, that's not how he died. And she has an interaction with the harlot whore. And that's not the interaction that they really had. So it's a little bit of a cheat, but
also I think you could say that, like, there's a reason why her character would keep that information back.
Exactly. And it goes in, he talks about it. Yeah. Like he talks about it. Like, you know, I'm not telling you the parts that I don't want you to know or something, you know, that Josh O'Connor says that. And
Josh O'Connor also talks about how, like, you can tell the truth by not saying the true part.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So there were a couple other instances, but again, like, I had so much fun. It's not a big deal. Like, I think you are honestly to kind of have to do that to make these work.
Yeah. The important part to know is that, like, there was a family, a family inheritance, a treasure that his grandfather used to refer to as Eve's apple.
Yes.
And that it was like something, you know, the Eve's apple would be returned to the tree, which they thought would be returned to the family tree. And it would be, you know, was also like the original sin that it's the money that he didn't, but he's like, if my harlot daughter wants it, she can have it, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But and that sort of sets at the backdrop of what, built up the Monsignor's character.
And this was, I knew that this was a very pivotal moment in the story. Like I kept thinking, all right, we're going to come back to this. And we did, but it was a great, it's definitely necessary to move the story forward.
Everything in these films is important. But it's also, Rian Johnson does this really great thing in these films where like a moment will happen that I will clock when it's happening, but I clock it for the wrong reasons. Like, I'm like, I notice it. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, but I don't even think like that's going to come back later. I just notice it. And then when it comes back later, I'm like, oh, I totally saw that. I just didn't.
I did not guess the end of this movie, but I guessed a lot. I guessed Glenn Close.
Yeah.
Like I knew, and I knew because the other, if the moment you're talking about is when she confesses to the Monsignor.
No, my moment that I'm talking about is when she screamed after the death.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When
yeah.
she screamed, I was like, that was a little like melodramatic for Glenn.
I agree. Yeah. That like, was one of them too. Yeah.
I thought it was a moment that like she as an actor was just like, it was a little like not there. And, but I totally clocked it. I was like, that was. And I didn't realize like, oh, duh. She and Rian Johnson are good enough storytellers and she's a good enough actor to like do a scream that sounds like a person pretending to scream.
Yes.
And or a performative scream. And I noticed it as like, oh geez, but then it comes back later. It's like, oh, she was doing that to distract
on purpose. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was great. Also, it was completely different than the scream when Thomas Hayden Church is dead.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can tell that cause I totally agree. I clocked that as like, wow, that was over the top. Like, but then when she screams with him, I'm like, wow, that seems very genuine. And with looking back, you can see like, oh yeah, that, I get that.
Which I love little stuff like that.
Like
there's a thing in Glass Onion. I talk about this in my spoiler free review where like Edward Norton's character is constantly saying words that aren't real words. But the first time I watched it, I noticed it every time. Like every time he would say a word, I'd be like, that's a weird word. But I thought what Rian Johnson was doing was he was just telling me as the writer, like, this guy's a real pretentious douchebag. And he says really fancy words that nobody else says. And it's just part. And I was like, I thought that's, which is true, but I didn't realize like, no, these are literally not words. He's just dumb. And like, that's going to be a big part of the reveal. But like, I was clocking it was happening. And then when it came back later, I was like, oh my gosh, I totally was.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So I think that Johnson's really good at that stuff of like having it be in plain sight.
He is. Yeah.
But yeah, let's get to the actual murder. So, what happens is,
like,
first of all, there's a really adversarial relationship between Monsignor, whatever his name is, and Wicks. Wicks and Father Judd. Father Judd disapproves of how Monsignor Wicks runs his parish.
And he relishes when people get up and leave.
Yeah.
He like focuses on someone and he like basically tries to get them to leave the sermon by pointing out their own flaws.
Yeah.
And like he seems to take pride in that. And he is a jerk. Like he's a total.
It's kind of different perspectives on what the role of religion and faith should be, because his belief is we're in a spiritual war and we're not looking for converts. We are fighting. Yeah. We are fighting our enemies. And so I'm not here to convert the enemy. I'm here to fight the enemy.
Yeah. It's an argument that is used a lot.
Yeah.
And then Father Judd, his is the exact opposite. He said, no, you know, Christ didn't come here to fight the world. He came to save it. Like we don't need to fight. Yeah. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I loved the two different differences in opinion, because they come up all the time.
Well, and Rian Johnson's really good in all these films at like giving all of his characters plausible motives.
Totally. Too.
You know, I would say like, I just rewatched Knives Out, and I would say like one of the problems of Knives Out, because a lot of people like refuse to believe that any of the other films can be better than Knives Out, because people have that weird thing where they're like, the first one has to be the best. But I'm like, I'd say the ancillary characters don't have as strong of motives in Glass Onion and this, like all of the characters have like really good motives, mm-hmm. even the main characters, even like the main protagonist. Whereas like Ana de Armas's character, I'm like, I don't believe for a second she would hurt Christopher Plummer, you know? And there doesn't seem to be any reason why she would, unless like the movie is lying to us about who she is fundamentally. Right. But anyway, whatever. But this movie, like Glass Onion, gives all of the characters really good motives, including Father Judd.
Yeah. Which I was questioning. I mean, you all in these movies, I'm always thinking, oh, is that guy, or did he do it? Like, you know, and with Father Judd, I was always questioning, well, maybe he could have done it. Like maybe I'm missing something, which I think Rian Johnson plays with that really, really well in this movie, which is, I think, kind of what you're talking about, like his motivation and like, cause he does lie. Father Judd does lie. Like it's, but yeah, we'll go on with the story. We'll get to that in a second, but
Father Judd's giving he gives a really, really, you know, enraged homily on Good Friday. And then when he gets down from his speech, he walks into this little, like, it's like a little utility closet that they have off to the side of the stage. And Father Jed explains that he would go in there after every speech to fortify himself because the speeches took so much out of him. And Father Judd would get up to continue the service and, you know, administer the sacrament and all that, you know, administer communion, all of that stuff. And he gets up to do his job. And like, it's like 10 seconds after Monsignor Wicks walks into this concrete closet, we hear him fall down and Father Judd looks over and he's face down. And when he goes over, he's dead and he's been stabbed to death by this knife. That the handle of it is this, it's this wolf head from a lamp that Father Judd took off of a lamp in a bar. You know, he was drunk at a bar. I always thought this was funny about Catholic priests that they're allowed to be alcoholics. It's like it's a funny trope.
In, it is a, yeah.
It's like no sex, but you can drink.
You can drink all you want.
Don't ever get married. No companionship, but you can have the bottle be your best friend. But yeah, he's mad at Monsignor Wicks and he feels defeated and he goes and, you know, goes on a bender and steals this little wolf head from a, from a lampshade. And
from like, what is it? It's like the devil's or Satan's bar. So
the bar looks like it's decorated like hell, which is fun.
It's kind of funny.
And it's like the local, you know, bar that everyone goes to. But he throws that handle at the church and we hear it break a window. And then the next day it shows up as the handle of this knife that is used to kill Monsignor Wicks. And, you know, we have ourselves a classic closed room murder mystery.
Yes. Where
it's like there's no way
in.
The impossible murder, no way in or out except for the door in. And that door was being watched. So how could the murderer have accomplished the murder? And that brings us to like, well, you got to get Benoit Blanc. You got to bring in.
Okay. So all of that happens. They get questioned. Mila Kunis comes in. She's the small town.
This was a surprise to see Mila Kunis. I did not know,
she
was in the movie. Yeah. So when she showed up, I was like, oh.
Yeah, it was good. It's good to see her. I thought she's kind of playing the Lakeith Stanfield role in Knives Out, which is like the smaller town cop. Anyway, I like these little.
We don't have one of those in Glass Onion.
Not in Glass Onion, no.
Yeah.
But I like that he's kind of working with some local. I liked that fact because like it implies a lot of story that we don't get, which I love because it's like he knows Mila Kunis somehow. Yeah. How does he know her? I don't know. Have they worked together? Same with Lakeith Stanfield, like in Knives Out. Like, how do they know each other? Like, and I think they actually do. They go.
He in Knives Out. He's hired by Chris Evans.
That's right.
Evans sends him a letter that's like, "Hey, come solve this murder." Because Lakeith Stanfield's like asking him. He's like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "I was."
Yeah,
hired.
That's right. That's right.
And he's like, So.
Yeah, but I like that they do have some. There's some sort of relationship there with Mila Kunis and Benoit Blanc. Who knows what it is, but I liked that we don't know, and it just it implies. Story.
Well, there's this whole implied like life of Benoit Blanc and mystique of Benoit Blanc that is all happens off screen. And there's this really funny runner. And basically the implied thing is like that he's very well known. He's infamous and he's solved countless crimes, you know?
Yeah.
And he's so well known that he's friends with celebrities and he like at the beginning of Glass Onion, when he's playing Among Us with a bunch of celebrities and they're actually like, it's celebrities playing themselves. Like they're not playing characters. They're playing themselves.
Right.
And Benoit Blanc is a celebrity detective. And there's this runner where like in all three films, when he's introduced to kind of our main protagonist character, they always bring up one of his past cases. They're like, "Hey, you're the guy that did the,
the Kentucky Derby, the close." Yeah.
And he's like, yes, that was me. And then he's like, "You were on The View." And he's like, I was, you know, but in all three movies, they do that. Like someone will be like, "You were the guy with the elevator at the Cannes Film Festival." And he's like,
I love that too. More implied story.
Just like this thing where we're like this other case that you didn't hear about. And, you know, but I think that it's like it's funny that people, it's also like kind of fantastical because in our real world there is no such thing as a famous detective. Like
so many cases cannot be solved or will not be solved.
But in this world, like that's a thing that exists. Is like the world famous detective Benoit Blanc. Just like the world famous detective Hercule Poirot, you know, like,
yeah, yeah.
And there's always sort of a trope in these things too, in Agatha Christie novels, of like, how does Hercule Poirot wind up at the scene of the crime? Yes. Who invites him? Who hires him? You know, and that's a part of these movies too. But yeah, he gets brought here by Mila Kunis. This first scene between the two of them is fantastic.
Oh, I mean, me and my coworker were talking about it, because he saw it at the Austin Film Festival. He actually got to listen to Rian Johnson talk because he was there, which I thought was pretty cool. But anyway, Rian Johnson talked about the movie, and he admitted that you kind of have to cheat a little bit in these, which sure. is great. Again, awesome. But I loved the fact that, like, I think the reason that these work so well is that it's not taken too seriously. And like you're talking about, it is kind of like a fantastical world. It's all very realistic. You know, the rules of all of our world is there, but they have these things that, like, you know, this, he can always solve the crime. He always knows exactly what happened. Like, that just doesn't happen in real life. But they also play with, like, the fact that they use comedy in this. You know, he's making each person, each flock member really represents a part of our culture, or a part of, you know, religion in this sense, that, like, some sort of sect of religion that's pretty extremist, right? Mm-hmm. So they all kind of represent these different factions of things, right? And I love in this scene between Judd and Benoit Blanc, the use of light.
Well, this becomes a motif throughout the entire film.
Yes.
This is something that a lot of people are talking about, that Johnson makes this choice to do something that you rarely ever see in movies, which is to kind of do the practical, like, this is the thing that happens in real life, where, like, sometimes you'll be in your house and a lot of natural light will be coming through your windows, yeah, and a cloud will go over the sun, and in a matter of, like, seconds, the light in your house will, like, dramatically shift, and it will get dramatic. And this happens several times in this film, where, like, characters are talking and then the mood of what their conversation shifts, and a cloud will go in front of the sun. And the light, because we're in a church and everything's lit by windows, the atmosphere in the room will completely shift. The color palette will shift. Yep. And it's like, it's so cool. It's such cool. This is another reason to see this in a theater.
Yes.
I mean,
and I loved it too. Like, you, and it was blatant.
Yep.
Again, like, and it was purposeful. Like, yeah. Benoit Blanc he says that he's not a religious guy, but then he starts getting, I mean, would you say he gets upset or
kind of angry?
Yeah, he gets kind of angry, and everything goes dark, you know, and it's like, it's all dark. And then Father Judd kind of comes with a rebuttal, but not in like a judgmental way, just kind of like, he's like, yeah, because Benoit Blanc is like, well, these are just all stories to make us feel better about ourselves. And he's like, yeah, these are stories, but they're stories that help us understand how things work. And it's written so much better than what I just said.
Yeah. I can't remember it either, like, but it's fantastic. But
it's the way that Father Judd says it is not being judgmental or putting Benoit Blanc down. It's just kind of like, well, you could also see it this way, which I
also like that we still don't know at this point. We're still trying to put the pieces together of like, okay, it's a surprise that Benoit Blanc shows up, because we thought we were reading the note that he was reading at the beginning of how the murder took place. And like, after this murder happens and Father Judd is distraught because he thinks the murder is going to get pinned on him. And he's begging, you know, he's praying and stuff. And Benoit Blanc shows up and we're like, wait, if Benoit Blanc is reading the note from Father Judd about the murder, how is he here? And we don't find out till later that as they're trying to piece everything together, because Benoit Blanc looks at Father Judd and he's like, I can solve this crime, but the answer is in your head, and I need you to go give it to me. He's like, so you're going to go in there and you're going to write down everything that happened since you showed up here.
Well, he also tells him, like, I know that you're innocent.
Yeah.
Which I thought was great, because he treats him that way the whole time. But even me, I was like, is he innocent? Yeah. Which we'll get to in a minute. But yeah, he tells him to write down. He's like, we're missing something. He's like, we're missing some piece. And I need you to write down the entire story. And that's when we get that. That's when we get to stopping the narration and then getting to, because
now we're back into real time. But also I like the sequence before this where Blanc is explaining the different possibilities of how a closed room murder can take
place. Yeah.
And so he's going through, and he's like, there, you know, there's like a few possibilities. And he goes like, he goes through like three scenarios in the very Benoit Blanc way where he's like performing the, you know, the explanations, but he stops short of explaining the last way. And this is another thing that I noticed where I was like, I thought he was like just two more. And then he explains one more and then they move on. And I was like, he didn't explain the fourth one, but I the movie moves on. So I like forgot maybe I thought like, oh, maybe he did do four and I just didn't, I don't know, but it comes back later that Mila Kunis is like, why didn't you say the fourth one?
Yeah.
And I also like this one, cause this is kind of a cheat too, is he lies to Mila Kunis because he needs more time.
Yeah.
And this is a thing that he does in the other movies too. Like in Knives Out, he does this where he's like, I need a little bit more time. So he like throws Lakeith Stanfield off the scent so that he can like have a little more time with Ana de Armas at one point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like he tells her, cause she's like, the only other possibility is that Father Judd went in that room and stabbed him in the back before anyone came up on stage to look.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah.
He does say yes. Yeah.
Which is, that's how it was done.
Yeah. Yeah. Which again, he's not saying that Father Judd did it. But they do show Father Judd doing it from Mila Kunis's perspective. So I thought this was also a good way, because I was like, man, maybe he did do it. Like, I don't.
Because when Benoit Blanc says like, yes, that is how it was done. You're like, oh, I mean, he means that is how it was done. I'm not saying Father Judd, but it was done by someone
in that way.
Yeah.
And before this though, we find out, because Father Judd writes out everything and then Benoit reads it and he's like, why did you do it? Which again makes us think, oh, maybe Father Judd did it. Like, you know, like they keep pointing us back to him, which I thought was very clever. And I thought Rian Johnson did it so well in his execution of everything. But, we find out that he lied about Monsignor Wicks. He doesn't just go to rest. He drinks. Like he was an alcoholic.
He keeps a flask in the electric thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Father Judd found the flask. He hid it from the cops and he took it because Thomas Hayden Church is a recovering alcoholic. And the only reason that he's still sober is because he thinks that Monsignor Wicks is also still sober.
And they're like in it together. And Father Judd didn't want to ruin his.
Yeah.
Cause he thinks of Samson too as the only good man.
Yes.
And he's like, he's the only
good one out of everybody.
And he's like, out of all these people in the parish, Samson's like the only good one. And I didn't want to ruin his sobriety in this moment of grief. And he's like, so I panicked and I hid the flask. And he's like, and then I went back later and I picked it up, you know?
Yeah.
But of course, Benoit Blanc being Benoit Blanc, he figures that out. Cause he's like, you were very clever by saying he would go in there to fortify himself. You didn't say what you meant by that. He's like, but you know, he can figure out like that. You're leaving parts out and I know what you're talking, you know?
Yeah. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. But, so that we're like, okay, so that like, he didn't necessarily kill him, but he hid this flask. But I also think Rian Johnson's really good at giving people reasons for doing the things that they did. Like there's a reason why Glenn Close omits some of the details of the story. Yeah. There's a reason why Father Judd phrases the things that the way that he does in the letter. And it's because he's trying to protect people. He's just like, well, I want to tell you the truth with this confession. I'm going to tell you, I'm telling you everything, but I'm leaving out a part that like, I'm not directly lying to you. I'm just not saying a part, you know, in its entirety. So now what happens?
Well, so I mean, you know, they kept saying Monsignor Wicks kept saying like, oh, I'm going to die and I'm going to be resurrected. And Glenn Close keeps saying that he's going to come back. He's going to come back. And I think this is when, they find Eve's apple and there's a lot that happens. There's no way that we can go over all this.
There's no way.
But they find Eve's apple. It's like a case and they try to break it open to see if the,
it's like a snow globe.
They believe that the fortune, they find out that the fortune was someone found it, that Monsignor Wicks found it. They find out from his illegitimate son.
Yeah.
Who is a character in this movie. He's one of the flock.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you notice how much this guy looked like Bradley Levi? But like if Bradley Levi was black.
I don't even know who Bradley Levi is.
Oh, Zachary Levi. Sorry, Zachary.
Oh, Zachary Levi. Oh, yeah, I could see that.
The first shot it showed him, I was like, is that Zachary Levi in blackface? Like, I genuinely was like, what?
Daryl McCormick. I can absolutely see that. Yeah, there's a similarity there. Yeah, there's a similarity for sure. They've got it. Yeah, yeah, that's funny.
It looks like when they do like those AI, like, what if Brad Pitt was black? Or like, what if Denzel Washington was white? And they like use AI to like,
you know. Man, I haven't seen those, but they sound interesting. Yeah.
It's terrible.
But they find out that there's, which I thought this was a great scene too. They're ripping up this snow globe thing to see if there's any sort of indication that they're looking for a Swiss bank account number that maybe was hidden in there. They don't find anything, but they find out that the tomb where Monsignor Wicks is buried is what's called a Lazarus door, where you can't open it from the outside. But if you were resurrected, you could just push it and it would come out really easily.
The moment they mentioned that in the movie, you're like, well, that's happening.
Yeah, me too. I was like that's going to happen. Yeah.
Well, that's happening. Like the movie is called Wake Up Dead Man. So I know, that's happening. Yeah. But, you know.
So yeah, they call the company that is supposed to mechanically take the door off, you know, like, and Father Judd starts talking to the woman who is really, really chatty and like, oh, you're, and but he's like really trying to get her to hurry up and like, give me this name, please give me this name. Like, this is really important. And then he stops because she actually has, which I thought this was handled so well, because she actually has this moment where she's like, I really need your help. Like, my mom has a tumor and she's got, you know, terminal cancer and the tumor's growing on her brain. She says horrible things. And I've been saying these horrible things back to her just because it just got to me. And I feel so alone. I'm afraid she's going to die. Mm-hmm. And then he just stops and he realizes that like, he needs to talk to this woman.
Yeah.
And I thought this was handled so well, because after this point, he decides, I'm done. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm just trying to save my neck when really I need to be helping other people.
Yeah.
And then, so that's when he goes and it's raining and he goes on the tomb and he sees the tomb opened. Right.
Yeah. And I like, because he sort of ditches the investigation too. He tells Benoit Blanc, he's like, listen, man, I'm done. He's like, I don't care. He's like, you can go and he's like, but I'm going to go be a priest. I'm going to go. And he tells him, he goes, I had a road to Damascus moment.
Yes.
Like, which is like a, you know, a story from the Bible about Paul like realizing on the road to Damascus, you know, that his calling. And he's like, my calling is to be a priest, not a detective. I don't know how I got caught up with you doing this Benoit Blanc stuff, but like, you go do your thing. I'm going to do my thing. But yeah, he witnesses this moment of the Lazarus door being open and what looks like Monsignor Wicks rising from the dead and exiting the tomb. And then it looks like he goes into the woods with Samson. And so he runs down to follow them into the woods. He gets knocked out. Someone punches him in the face. And when he wakes up, he's holding a like scythe that's in Samson's chest.
Yeah.
And so he thinks he killed Samson and he's like freaks out and he's like, you know what? I'm going to go turn myself in, this was also another great, like Benoit Blanc, like he sees him about to do it and he just grabs him. He's like, nope.
Yeah, he's like, no, come on over here. Yeah. It was so, that part was so funny.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I'm going to go. And he's like, no. And they go out in the car. And he's like,
I need to turn myself in. But he's like, no, I don't think that you actually, Benoit Blanc knows like you didn't actually do that.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to the bottom of it.
And all his followers, all of Monsignor Wicks's followers find out that he's been resurrected. Right.
Right.
And so they're like trying to get to see this thing.
Yeah.
But Benoit takes Father Judd and where do they go after this? I'm trying to remember.
I think they go over to the doctor's house, Jeremy Renner's house. And we saw something earlier with Jeremy Renner where someone knocked on his door and he opened the door and we assumed it was Monsignor Wicks.
Because he's dead. Like, praise be, it's accomplished, right?
Yeah. You know, yeah. And the way that the knocks happen, this is kind of like a cheat too, like,
yeah,
like I don't think that Glenn Close would be knocking like that on his door, but it's done for dramatic effect.
Yeah.
But they go over to Jeremy Renner's house and his house is like destroyed and they go down into the basement. Now I had this thought and maybe I don't know if you did too. They're walking into his basement and they sort of like recoil and they're like, oh, the smell down here is terrible. Yeah. There's this storyline where Jeremy Renner's wife and kids left him and he becomes like increasingly more and more detached and like angry. Yeah. I had this thought all of a sudden of like, did he murder his family and are they going to find his family in the basement? And like, is like, and I was like, that would be really dark for these films. Like that would take this in a really, even though these are all murder films, like a guy murdering his family, like his wife and kids would, you know, that's not what's down there. But what he finds is, what they find is the body of Monsignor Wicks is like bent over a vat of acid and his arms are in the vat and his arm, I mean, all the flesh on his arms are gone and they drain the vat and the skeleton of Jeremy Renner's character, the doctor, is in there.
Yeah.
And so it looks like, you know, the zombie body of Monsignor Wicks grabbed the doctor and dunked him in the acid and like, and killed
kept
him. And
then, down there to kill him. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like died himself.
Yes.
And again. I love how, and I love how this just like deepens the mystery of all of it. Cause we're like, we, the audience are like, we know that he was dead. We saw him at the coroner's.
Yeah.
Like we, like,
When they flip him over on his side.
That seems really funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
But flip. Yeah.
Yeah. It really does. And it's, I mean, again, there's so much in this movie that we didn't get. I want to know though, cause there's a part when they keep flashing back and they show the final homily, I believe, of Josh Brolin, and he's talking about all these things, but this is when I like knew, like I was thinking that okay, it's probably Glenn Close like the whole time, but then this is kind of when I knew, because he says, you know, there's a Judas in here, and right after he says Judas in here, they cut to a scene with everybody, and Glenn Close is there. And Glenn Close is the first person to speak after he says Judas. Mm. She's like, I need some time with the body. And then you hear the rest of Josh Brolin's line. And I was like, oh, it's her. She's the Judas. Because they, in their editing, they cut from Judas to her. Did you catch that?
I didn't. You know, and I, like, honestly, he threw me off the scent of Glenn Close with the scene where he confronts everybody and tells them all what he's going, how he's going to expose them, but he doesn't say anything about her.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I thought he was working with her. I thought she was involved, but I thought they were working together somehow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that she was actually going to like betray him to try to take the fortune for herself.
Well, and I don't think she won't. Well, I didn't see it as taking the fortune for herself. I saw it as, which I thought initially, I was like, okay, the reason that she's doing it is because he messed up and she
wants
mad
to protect the church. Yeah. Yes.
And that ultimately is kind of, I mean, there's way more to it than that, but I was happy that I at least got that. Like Glenn Close is the one.
I do like this. Like we wind up back at the church with everybody and Benoit Blanc is doing his big monologue
checkmate.
And I like that the movie like makes fun of this, that like early on Benoit Blanc's like, it's gonna be a sight to see when I get there, trust me. It's like, when I get to my big checkmate, you're gonna want to be there. He's like, it's pretty awesome when I put all the pieces together. And he's doing it and he's in the middle of it, he's explaining like that, like he knows how all the pieces fit. And we do another lighting shift here where like the lighting is kind of cold. The clouds are over the sun and the clouds move away from the sun and the sun shines through the window on him. And he looks up and he's like, ugh. And he decides not to explain what happened.
Yeah.
And it's as in the audience, you're like, what's he doing? Like, why, you know? And he says, Damascus, like,
you
know?
Yeah.
But what he's doing is he's letting Glenn Close turn herself in and confess herself.
Yeah. To like release her. Cause Father Judd in earlier on in the movie said, listen, I've got to do this or it's not going to mean anything. Like, and I'm trying to remember, I think he said he needs to help. It all relates back to that he needs to be the one who chooses to turn himself in and chooses to confess, because then it's more meaningful to him. And that's what Benoit sees in Glenn Close.
Well, and he sees also that like she's dying. Like he knows that she's dying. Yes. And so he's like, and he also knows this woman, the reason why she did what she did is because she felt like Monsignor Wicks had betrayed the church and betrayed
she felt it was altruistic.
Yeah. And so he's like, I want to give her the opportunity to do this on her own terms. Yeah. And he lets her have the moment, and she comes back into the church and sort of tells her story of how she got, you know, the doctor to put this
tranquilizer
into the Monsignor's flask, so when he drank from his flask he passed out, and then they had affixed a handle of the knife to his robe because it's the same color.
Yeah, two devil handles. Yeah,
I really liked this too. That there's a scene earlier in the film where Benoit Blanc is looking at a photo of the bar, and I also just like the composition of the shot that the bartender is smiling in one and not in the other, and and the bag of the doctor is in both, which is also a clue that like the doctor's involved. But he keeps saying, "Do you see it? Do you see it?" And he keeps showing us both photos. And I was literally like, what am I supposed to be seeing?
I know, me too.
I'm like, I know Rian Johnson is just showing it to us.
Yes.
But the detail that we're meant to be seeing is so small that like no one could possibly see it.
Yeah.
But it's right there, which is that there are two lampshades. And in the older photo, the other lampshade also has a devil head on top of it.
Yeah.
And so there, and in the, when he puts the photo down, they're both missing. And not just the one that that Father Judd took earlier. So he's like, there was a fake devil head affixed to his thing. And then
and it had a little squib in it so that there would be blood. Yeah.
And that explains this other thing from earlier in the film. Yeah. The signal,
the remote control. Yeah.
He's like, and then when, so it's Samson and the doctor and Glenn Close who are all working together on this plot.
Yeah. Samson is doing it because he loves Glenn Close.
Uh huh.
And Glenn Close is like, everything, this is all how it's supposed to do. So she kind of manipulates him because he is really the only good person kind of in all of it.
And the doctor's vulnerable because his family's left him and he's kind of emotionally like,
and he had access to tranquilizers.
Yeah. when the doctor goes in to examine him, he says like, you know, don't touch the knife to Father Judd.
Yeah.
And when Father Judd steps out, Glenn Close screams. There's that scream that I noticed.
Yeah.
And that makes Father Judd turn his head and everyone looks away. And when that happens, Jeremy Renner switches the knife and stabs
him.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So now he's dead. Luckily that one stab worked and actually killed him.
Yeah.
But basically what like the thing was, is they found out that Monsignor Wicks had, he felt like he had found the family fortune, but Glenn Close knows where it is. And she was like, well, if he knows where it is, then he's going to, she found out that he was going to open the Lazarus tomb where his grandfather was, because she knows how his grandfather actually died, which is Eve's apple is this crazy diamond you know, that
pink diamond,
which I was sort of still like, okay, so this guy spent $80 million on this diamond. Yeah. If you tried to resell this on the market, would it sell for?
If it's $80 million, diamonds appreciate, it'd probably actually be worth more.
Maybe, or would someone just be, I don't know, who knows? I just was like, that's a weird way to convert a fortune, but
yeah,
I've never understood.
You just take a jump. Yeah.
Sure. I've never understood what gives diamonds their value.
Diamonds do appreciate. That's it's crazy. But
so, it's a big enough rock that he swallowed it and that killed him.
Yeah. He
choked. And And so the idea is, his decomposed body should contain this diamond. So Josh Brolin was going to remove the door, go in there and get it. But before he could do that, she's like, let's actually kill him. And then we'll swap his body out for Samson in a trick coffin. And Samson will open up the coffin, get the diamond, knock the door down, dressed as Monsignor Wicks. Yeah. So that's who was, you know, I love the way that these pieces all come together.
Yeah.
And
he comes out. So he looks, I also thought this was a little bit of a cheat because I think it was Josh Brolin that was actually doing it in some of the shots. But I have to go watch it again because maybe it is. I don't know. We'll see. But also they have flashes that were absolutely Josh Brolin. But you could also say that it was from Judd's perspective. So that's kind of what he was seeing. But ultimately what happens in that scene is Father Judd comes down and he follows them in and Thomas Hayden Church knocks him out. That's the one who knocked him out. But then Jeremy Renner, seeing that he could take this fortune and take the diamond for himself, he's the one who killed Samson.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn Close knew that he was going to do that. So she goes to his house and he's the one that says to her, you know, praise be, it's accomplished or whatever.
Right.
And he laced her coffee with the same tranquil or that they have that certain, I don't know, there's some sort of drug that kills you in like 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And she drops the diamond and she switches the glasses so that Jeremy Renner doesn't see. Jeremy Renner's the one who ingested the poison. Which I also thought, like, he goes upstairs and he's like, he dies. It's pretty funny. They show his body coming down the stairs.
That was a really good little comedic beat of him. Down the stairs. Yeah.
But I also thought, how is Glenn Close going to get this man?
I know.
Not a big deal. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
She gets him into the vat. She also moved
Monsignor Wicks
to make it look like he was choking him. She filled it up. She left with the diamond, and that's kind of how it all shakes out.
And then she gives she takes the poison herself because she feels so bad. And this is her final confession. She's confessing to Father Judd, and she gives Father Judd Eve's apple and is like, "Hey, it's yours to do with what you will."
Well, no, she doesn't. She doesn't give it to him.
Oh,
she drops it. She still has it.
Oh yeah.
But she also does say, she's like, "Please forgive me for all the people that I killed." And then Father Judd said, "But what's the mom's name? It's Grace." He's like, "What about Grace?" And that is the harlot whore, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, "I don't think you understand like what she went through. She went through so much judgment." And then they kind of play the scene back. They play the scene back in another moment, and you really see that the mom was not this horrible person. She really did have to go through a lot, and it recontextualizes her as a character. And we find out that Glenn Close as a child said, "I know where he hid it, but you're never going to find it." That's why she attacked her.
Right.
And then Glenn Close does say, "Grace, like, yeah, please forgive me for." I thought this was a really, somehow he pulled it off. Obviously having Glenn Close, you're going to, you know, she knows how to act and she's amazing.
Yeah.
But it was really, really good. So she gets it all off of her chest. And I mean, she dies, and then she drops the Eve's apple.
Mm.
And Father Judd and Benoit look at each other, and Benoit's like,
he's like, you know, I didn't see anything, you know?
Yeah.
But then Father Judd has this, it's kind of this thing of like, are you going to fall prey to the temptation?
Yes.
And it's like, sort of like, think of all the good that you could do with this money.
Yep.
And, you know, I just love the way that Johnson ties these all up with a nice bow. Yeah. All three of these movies have a really great ending.
Yes.
And this one has just such a satisfying like last punch because he's a woodworker, he makes this crucifix and he makes like a wood, image of Christ on the crucifix. And he's, you know, he's preaching as the new sort of head priest of this parish. And the camera zooms in on the crucifix and goes into the rib cage of Christ and right there in his heart.
Yeah.
And once again, we do this motif of the sun moving, the light of the sun moves through the window and goes across the chest. And there we see Eve's apple inside the chest. And
It really, like, there's so much more to this movie. And like the symbolism, the themes, everything, like it all works so extremely well. And it's a great, I'm very interested to see what people think of it, because a lot of I could see a lot of really conservative Christians thinking that the movie is coming after them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also like, listen, if you got to stay to the end of this movie, because if you want to show growth, you have to show, if you want to show the light, you've got to show the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, it definitely is a criticism of some, you know, religious people, but it's also, in the end, Father Judd is really, he's the one that, like, this is what it can be, right? This is what religion can be and what it probably should be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, stay to the end. You know, that's really the message. It's not really a criticism of religion in general. I think it's really kind of, this is how it, you know, it can be. And it, you can have respect for somebody who's an atheist and you can be a religious person. It can all work out.
Yeah. Yeah. I again, this movie's walking that line in a way where it's like, I definitely think people from all walks of life can appreciate what he's doing here narratively. Yeah. And again, it's just another fantastic entry into what is an excellent trilogy and what I hope becomes just an excellent series. I just hope to see more of these. So let's get into scores. We give scores on this show for technical rating. That's just writing, acting, craft, cinematography, lighting in this movie. Oh my goodness. All that stuff. We give a score for the ending. We give a score for rewatchability. We have a score for cultural significance and impact, and a score for just our subjective feelings about the film. All that stuff aside, how did we subjectively like it? So Kramer, what is your technical rating for Wake Up Dead Man?
My technical rating is a 9.5. The movie was shot. It's beautiful. The acting is amazing. Like everybody's at top form. I think I'm docking it a little, mainly just, I mean, it plays really well. It is a little bit long. And sometimes I'm kind of like, okay, we can kind of move this on a little bit quicker. It dragged just a tiny bit, but honestly, I don't think a lot of people are gonna, I don't think that's really detrimental, but I also feel like maybe some things could have been shaved a little bit to kind of move it a little bit more. And also, Rian Johnson's a little heavy-handed in his feelings. I don't think he ever crosses a line to like, okay, this is ridiculous. But he's on that line of like, okay, I get what you're saying. Like sometimes it gets a little too much, but it's not bad.
Yeah, I gave this movie a 9. If I was to get nitpicky about this one, it would be that I feel like the ensemble characters aren't as well realized or developed as they are in maybe the other editions. I feel like in Glass Onion, everyone's like, I have a really clear idea of who each of these characters are, and they're really rich and like interesting. And here I was like, oh, I want a little bit more on Kerry Washington or a little more on, but I get enough to understand them enough, you know?
Yep.
And again, like, I don't know that it makes sense to try to rank these movies. They're all so good. And I think my subjective favorite is probably Glass Onion. I think it just like the tone of that movie works for me the best. But I just like all three of them so much. So I could even bump this up to a 9.5. I think that technically Rian Johnson does such a sharp job with these and the filmmaking is like really, really strong. How about the ending for you?
The ending I gave a 9. It all wraps up really nicely. It's kind of crazy how it all wraps up. It's like, wow. That's it's kind of great. But I really like the message that it gives in the end and how all the characters play out. Like Benoit Blanc has a moment, you know, his Damascus moment, but he doesn't convert.
No.
Like he's still an atheist. He's still and
I thought when that was happening, I was like, is he like having like a realization I was like, wait, what? But then I liked that it was just like, he's like, no, I respect that. I feel like Father Judd would want me to do it this way.
You know? I appreciate that too. Again, like he still has his ideals as far as religion are concerned. And so does Judd. And I love their relationship. So I think he was able to end it very, very well and very, very satisfying in pretty much every way.
Yeah, I gave the ending a 10. Nice. Of the three that I just rewatched, this one is, I mean, they're all, the ending is like why you watch the movie. Like you want to watch how it all wraps up. And the ending of this one is so, everything was so satisfying. And it really just was like on that last shot, that last push in, I just was like, what a way to just stylistically put a button on it and make me feel like right on, man.
Right.
I gave it I'm like, I don't know how you do it much better than that. How about rewatchability?
Rewatchability, I gave an 8, and maybe I should go higher, but, cause I mean, this is a fun movie, especially this is a movie on rewatch. You're going to catch a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll probably give it an 8.5. But also it's a little bit long. So sometimes it's hard to watch those, but you could pick up on this and, you know, especially on multiple viewings, you're going to get a lot more out of this movie. So,
Yeah, I gave it a 9 for rewatchability. Having just rewatched the first and second one, I realized like, oh, this is such a rewatchable franchise.
Yeah,
like this is this is just like there's so because it was only the first, it was only the second time I'd seen Knives Out and Glass Onion, these rewatches.
Yeah,
and I was like, how come I'm not rewatching these more often? They're so much more interesting on rewatch. Like there's just, there's so much that you see that you didn't see the first time. And I imagine it will only get that way more and more on successive rewatches. How about cultural impact?
Cultural impact. I'm saying an 8. Cause I mean, this is a big, you know, it's the third one in the series. I think it's going to be just as popular as the other ones. I do think that if these were all theatrical releases, they would have a bigger cultural impact. So that I almost want to downgrade it a little bit because Netflix doesn't really have movies will come out and it'll be an impact for like a week or two.
Yeah.
But like, since they're not in theaters, they're not, we don't talk about them all that. How much do we talk about Leave the World Behind or Bird Box anymore? Like Netflix, but like we talk about these other movies that maybe weren't even as good as those, but they came out in the theater and they're more resonant in our mind because we made the effort to go and see them. So I think that that's going to be a big detriment to this movie, but also not that big because this is one of the bigger titles that they have. So
I think it's a very good point that you make. I gave it an 8 just because I hope that this movie, this franchise continues to build and grow.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, it's an important installment in the franchise to show like this is now 3 movies in, 3 really, really solid films. It shows that this franchise like doesn't need to slow down anytime soon. But I think you make a really good point about the cultural impact on a larger scale being sort of hamstrung by these just sort of being dumped onto Netflix a week after their limited theatrical release. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that affects their overall legacy down the road. What's your subjective score?
My subjective score is a 9. I loved it. I had a ton of fun. I think everybody should see it. And I think there's going to be people who love it, people who hate it, I'm sure, but go see it. It's a great time.
My subjective score is also a 9. Man, I love November and December. Every year, it's just like all the movies are great. So our last 2 movies that we saw were just absolutely delightful. I really hope our next film that we're watching will be equally great. I really want this movie to like get to me emotionally, and I hope it does. We're going to be watching Chloe Zhao's new film, Hamnet, the William Shakespeare kind of tragedy with Paul Mescal and what's her name?
Jessie Buckley.
She's so great. We're going to go watch that. So go watch that in the theater if you want to watch along with us, and let us know in the comments what you thought of Wake Up Dead Man. You know, things that you saw that maybe we didn't talk about on the show and little details, little clues, all that stuff. And tell us, you know, what your favorite one in the series is and why, and like, share, comment, subscribe, all of that stuff. And we will see you on the next one.
Bye-bye.